Tonight is Lag BaOmer, and last night we counted 32. And Lag BaOmer is, I think it's safe to say Lag BaOmer is the most mysterious day on a calendar. You ask anybody what's Lag BaOmer about, and they'll hem and they'll haw, and then they'll say something kind of mealy-mouthed like, well, Rav Shimon Bar Yochai's Yahrzeit, which then you'll then ask them two questions. Well, you won't ask them one of them, but we're going to deal with it, which is, how do you know it's a Yahrzeit? And second of all is, since when is a Yahrzeit occasion for celebration? And next we're going to deal with both those things. But then I say, oh, okay. Actually, it's because Rabbi Akiva's students stopped dying. All right. So there's a whole bunch of problems with that answer, and I'll address them quickly. One of them is something that we've dealt with in the past here, which is that the reason for mourning during this period, to credit it with mourning because of Rabbi Akiva's students, is difficult. It's really difficult.
Why?
It's difficult for the following reasons. Reason number one is, the most obvious one is, that with any of the sources, which we have at least four sources in rabbinic literature that tell the story of Rabbi Akiva's students, and they're not consistent with each other as far as the numbers go, but regardless, none of them make any mention of any prohibition or custom or anything that was taken on by anybody as a result of this tragedy. The second thing is that the very first time, and this is a part of that, the very first time that we ever hear of anybody discussing any sort of prohibition or restraint or different custom during this period is 800 years after the fact. In other words, Rabbi Akiva's students died in the 2nd century. The first time we ever hear about it is in the 10th century, when pretty much simultaneously, in Bavel and in Sfarad, the question is asked, is people not getting married now a prohibition or is it a custom? And the answer in both cases is, and this answer is the same, it's a custom of mourning. They attribute it to the students of Rabbi Akiva, and that's mainly because there's a custom to not do something in Pesach and Shavuot. What bad thing do we know that happened then? So kind of plug them together. But their whole point of the tshuva is to say it's a minhag and not an isur, and if somebody violates it, no consequences. But if they ask us, we tell them to get married afterwards. Even in the 13th century in Italy, we hear that there are some communities where they have a custom not to get married during this time, which means it wasn't universal. The Rambam makes no mention of it, by the way. And people propose different explanations for why people don't get married now, because it's just a really weird custom. So the silence, both from the 800 years of no mention of any practice during the period reflecting that, and the fact that when the custom finally is noticed, people make different suggestions as to why it is, proves one thing. Nobody knows why we don't have weddings now.
What is the first mention of the students dying?
The first mention of students dying shows up in four different sources. The earliest one is probably Bereishit Rabbah's earlier. It's in Bereishit Rabbah. It's also in Kohelet Rabbah in a parallel. And then in those cases, it's 12,000 students. It's in Bavli of Amot. So that's going to be later than that. And that has 12,000 pairs of students, famous. And then later on, you have the Medrash Tanchum in Vayishlach that mentions 300 students. So you have a whole range of...
So it's about 400?
It's a little later than that. Talmud Bavli, you're going to talk about an editing of about 6th century. And Tanchum is going to be even later than that. But when did Rabbi Akiva live? Rabbi Akiva died around the year 140, so his students are killed before 140, and presumably they were killed as members of Bar Kokhba's rebellion. And so to have absolute halachic silence for the next 800 years until finally somebody says, hey, what's this thing with people not getting married, seems to be kind of strange. The other thing is that, just very quickly, because I want to get to Lag BaOmer, but is that please show me a precedent anywhere in halacha for mourning for anybody who's not your relative. It doesn't exist. We do have mourning for the city of Yerushalayim, for the Beit HaMikdash, but we don't have mourning for any individual, no matter how many of them and no matter how important they are, who's not a direct relative. And even mourning for a relative is something that's never repeated.
What about other cultures?
We don't have mourning repeated, meaning you have mourning for Shiva, for Shloshim, if you're Beit Chodesh, then you're done. You then have a Yahrzeit, but Yahrzeit's not a mourning thing. It's a commemoration of sorts. And so that's very difficult. The other thing is a 7-week is a very weird period. And the other thing is that the way the story is presented is that these students died because there was some ethical fault in them. So it's not as if you were to tell me that all 10 of the martyrs died in one day, and so we're going to have a fast day on that day or mourn on that day, I kind of get it. I mean, these are people who were innocent people, who were righteous people, who were killed by the Romans, and supposedly for the sale of Yosef, wherever the Midrash plays, I get it.
But they didn't all live at the time.
But I know that's true, so that, I mean, theoretically. But with Rabbi Akiva's students, very difficult. And that's why the Rishonim search for other explanations as to why there's this custom. And we've dealt with it in a different shiur, but in any case, I just wanted to point out that saying that Lag BaOmer is a holiday because the dying stopped, even if you want to start with the premise that the mourning during this period is because of Rabbi Akiva's students dying and that there was a break on Lag BaOmer, which is not mentioned in the Makorot, there is the Nusach Ad Prosad Zeret, but doesn't mean that there was like a break on that day. And so for those people who have the custom, for instance, to have mourning during the period, take Lag BaOmer off and then go back to mourning, it's even stranger. But even if you want to accept that, let's just ask the simple question. Let's say there's a terrible plague and every day people are dying and you're carting people out of the city or whatever the reason is that they're dying, however you're dealing with them, and then one day nobody dies. You're making a yontif? In the middle of a plague, you're going to make a yontif? I mean, it's a little bit strange. So the reality is, Lag BaOmer is a very mysterious day. We're going to try to unravel that mystery today in this shiur. All right? We're going to start with the kind of source that you won't usually hear me sharing, not for any reason except that it's just not my area of right? Is that, as you well know, in the 16th century... as Jews, from the beginning of the 16th century, as Jews were making their way out of the Iberian Peninsula at the end of the 15th century, for the most part, they went east. I mean, they all went east. But they went east, for the most part, across the northern Mediterranean. Some of them went across into Africa and went across the Mediterranean, but they all migrated east. And the ones who migrated east across the northern Mediterranean went to Italy, where they were welcomed to some extent. They went further to Greece and to several different islands there. So some of them settled in Rhodes and some of them settled in Salonika. And that's where those communities were created, the communities that in some cases were only wiped out in World War II. They lasted and thrived till then. And some of them made their way to Istanbul. And so all of these people are legitimately Sephardim. They really came from Sephard. And some of the Jews who went to Turkey hung a sharp right and went south. And there were families that had lived in Turkey for 20, 30, 40 years, maybe even two generations, and then their kids migrated and made Aliyah and came to Israel. And in the 16th century, there was a thriving community, small, but thriving in a sense, vibrant is probably the word, community in a small hilltop town called Sfat. And we all know that Tzfat was a mecca for mystical type of studies and people who were drawn to that. And in the later 16th century, there was a chacham who made Aliyah from Egypt. He was all of 36 years old when he made Aliyah. He came from Egypt. His name was Yitzhak Luria. And because whenever they would quote him, they would quote him by saying, Amar Rabbi Yitzhak or Amar Rabbeinu Yitzhak. He got known by the sobriquet Ari, and that was the Ari. Oh. And he made Aliyah when he was 36 years old, and he then became sort of the spiritual leader, if you will, of the Tzfat community. He wasn't the Rav of the community. There was another person who was the Rav, and we're going to hear a story about him. It's kind of a shocking story. What? They came from different places. I don't know. And so he was like this the spiritual leader of the town. And in the town at the time, we learned about this years ago, that's where some of the customs around the beginning of Shabbat, including some of Kabbalat Shabbat, the custom of going out to greet Shabbat, and some of the Psalms said before, developed in Sfat. And so he had a student who came to study with him, who outlived him by a lot, because the Arizal actually came to Sfat when he was 36 and died when he was 38. His whole ministry in Sfat was 2 years, around 1570, I think. And no idea. And he had a student there, Chaim Vital, who was considered to be among the probably the one of the two foremost students of the Arizal. And Chaim Vital wrote a book. One of the books he wrote is called Pre-Eitz Chaim. And what you have in front of you is Pre-Eitz Chaim, a little piece from it, passage one. And in it, he talks about Lag Bomer. So we'll talk about Lag Bomer and watch what his reflections are. And we're one of the common conceptions, which is likely a misconception about Lag Bomer, came, and also some very strange behavior here, which actually is going to be the key to figuring out what's going on. Bizman hazeh. Binyan ha'ochim al ha'kever Rashbi v'Rabbi Elazar b'no b'meiron b'lag ba'omer. So he says, I want to talk about this custom people have. I've got going lag ba'omer, going to Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai and his son Rabbi Elazar to their grave. Ani ra'iti l'mori zal. Now that means Chaim Vital is writing about the Ari who's already dead. Right? I saw him. Zesh moneh shanim, which means 8 years ago. Shalach im ishto v'im beito v'yasham gimel yamim ahim. So meaning that I can attest that my Rebbe went and spent 3 days there, and it was some sort of a pilgrimage, so there's something to it. And he's going to add to it. Ha'irli, I don't know who this is, Shishana achad kodem shehikarti oto, so 1 year before I met the Arizal, and it was before I came to meet the Arizal, Shahalach sham legaleach et b'no, b'mishteh v'simcha b'yamim. He actually went up and gave his kid a haircut, this custom, and there was big festivity during that time. And what happened then? Gam Hirli Arav Avraham Alevi. Rav Avraham Alevi was the rabbi of Tzfat. Right? And he says, Ki Yumaya Noeg Lomar Nachem Bevirchat Tishkon. Tishkon is the Nusach Sfard version, not Nusach Sfard, Nusach Sfardim, Edot Mizrach version of the Yerushalayim Ircha. And he had the custom, this Rabbi Avraham Alevi had a custom on that day of saying Nachem in Birchat Yerushalayim. When do we say Nachem? It's one time a year. He would say Nachem on that day. So now the Arizal was standing there, and this rabbi was saying, davening evidently out loud, and said Nachem.
In the repetition or in
his own? Probably in his own tefillah, but it was evidently out loud. They heard him. And the Arizal turns around to him and says, I'm saying in the name of Rav Shimon bar Yochai, who's buried here 1,400 years already, right? Sha'amarli emor la'ish hazeh. He told me that I should tell you, the rabbi, lamhu omer nachem biyom simchati. Why are you saying nachem on my festive day? Right? Lachen hu yeh benachama bizman karov. And so the rest of the Arizal's channeling of the Rashbi was that this rabbi is himself going to need nechama very soon. V'chein lo yatza chodesh ad shemei b'no agadol. Within a month, this rabbi's eldest son died. V'kibel kos tan nechama alav, and he was comforted for him. In other words, this is a curse. It was because he had done a terrible thing. Now saying nachem on this day, what's so terrible? Nir'emi kol zeh. So Chaim Vital says, what do you see from here? There's actually something to this thing of going out on Lag Bomer. You see that the Arizal would go with his family and give him a haircut, and there was this whole big ruckus with Nachem. There must be something to this going out there. V'hatam, what's the reason? Shemait Rashbi b'yom Lag Bomer. Right? The reason is because Rashbi died on Lag Bomer, which of course is a very strange thing. All right? Then he adds the following. Kimi Talmidei Rabbi Akiva Hanal. He himself, Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, was one of the students of Rabbi Akiva. Shemetu b'Sfirat HaOmer Hanal, who died during Sfirat HaOmer. So now, he's taking the position that, whether it's because the morning itself, but Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai died on Lag BaOmer because he's one of the students of Rabbi Akiva. Now, this is difficult for lots of reasons. Reason number one is that in every version of the story of Rabbi Akiva's students, which, by the way, the purpose of that story is not to talk about not getting married or anything else. It's never mentioned. The purpose of that story in every one of the sources is to say that even if you had students when you're young, you should have more students when you're older because you don't know what's going to happen to them. And the proof is from the story of Rabbi Akiva's students. Rabbi Akiva had all these students, however many there were. They're all killed. And then he restarted with his next generation of students, who included Rabbi Meir, Rabbi Yehuda, and Rabbi Shimon. And every one of the versions of the story that has new chachamim and has different group of chachamim, always has the same four: Rabbi Yosef, Rabbi Yehuda, Meir, and Rabbi Shimon, Shimon Bar Yochai. In every version of the story, they are part of Rabbi Akiva's second generation of students after the plague, which means that this contradicts all of that. Second thing is that it also kind of gives light to the idea that the students didn't die in Lag BaOmer, because they're saying he did die in Lag BaOmer as part of that plague, which would then make the whole story very strange. So we have a few things to figure out about this paragraph. One thing is, why would dying be a yontif? Second of all, this whole connection with Rabbi Akiva's students works backwards. Third of all, why was the rabbi saying Nachem? And then what's so terrible about saying Nachem? Why would he be saying it? So we have several mysteries here. Parenthetically, just as a side point, in the early 19th century, there had already been a noticeable aliyah, which is purely religious aliyah. This is before the aliyot of the late 19th century that were socialist and that were building the land. This was aliyot that happened already in the late 18th centuries of Jews who were sent by their communities to go and to one of the four holy cities of Tzfat, Tveria, Yerushalayim, and Hebron, and sit and study and fast and daven, and the community supported them. That's where the kollelim started. And there was a fund that would come and support them from the towns in Europe. And these people who came to this custom of going up to Meron for this big festivity on Lag BaOmer was such a big custom that the Chatam Sofer in this tshuva says that he would not want to go to Israel, because then he would be faced with the reality that he could not go to Meron. He thinks it's wrong to go to Meron, but he doesn't want to break away from the community, so he's not going to go. And the reason he thinks it's wrong is because that as long as we venerate another location, that delays the rebuilding of Yerushalayim. Interesting take. I'm not bringing it for a theological perspective, just a historic perspective of saying, already in the early 19th century, Meron was a big festival. By now, the bonfires are going at this hour, and it's live streams and everything else. But even then, it was already a very big thing.
Why Meron?
What? Because that's where Shem Baruch is buried. Uh-huh. Right, it's buried. So now, we have several questions on the table. The first question, which is the biggest question, is, what's Lag BaOmer all about? Then we also have to ask, what's this Nachem being said on Lag BaOmer? Very strange. And what does Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai's death have to do with anything, and how does that fit into the whole picture? So, turn the page. I'm going to ask you a question. Where is the first time that Lag BaOmer, or the 18th of Iyar, is mentioned in any Jewish text anywhere? I mean, from the Bed of Bereishit until the Mishnah Berurah, anything. You know, 3,000 years of Jewish texts. Where's the first time it's mentioned? It's not mentioned in Tanakh anywhere. Not the date, even as an incidental date of anything happening. It's not mentioned anywhere in Shas, Bavli, Yerushalmi. Not mentioned in the Midrashim. The first place it shows up is in an interesting book. And the name of the book is Megillat Tanit Batra. And I'll explain what that is. We're all familiar with Megillat Tanit. We've talked about Megillat Tanit numerous times. Megillat Tanit is an ironic name because it's actually a scroll of days on which you're not allowed to fast, right? And it lists all sorts of days during the year, starting from the beginning of Nisan, and the Megillah itself is this big. That's it. It's one page where it just lists days. You can't fast on this day, it's called this thing. You can't fast on this day, it's this thing. You can't fast on the 14th, 15th of Adar, it's Yom HaDepuraya. You can't fast from the 25th of Kislev for 8 days, it's Yom HaDechonako.
Good things happen.
Good things happen, either military or political victories. Military victories for the Hashmonaim, etc., or political victories for the rabbis, right, including getting Shavuot to not only be on Sunday, that famous battle. Those are all festive days, and some days you're not allowed to mourn.
It's always a particular day, not a period of time.
Sometimes a period of time. So Hanukkah is 8 days. The first 8 days of Nisan is a time, and most of them are single days or maybe 2 days, different periods when stuff happened. That's Megillat Tanit that's mentioned by the Gemara. The Gemara recognizes it. The Gemara also rules that Batlad Megillat Tanit, we don't observe any of those days, with the exception of Chanukah and Purim. And, matter of fact, one of the days that you're not allowed to fast is Yom Nikanor, the 13th of Adar, which is pretty odd because that's Tanit Esther. So we clearly don't abide by Megillat Tanit anymore. However, in the Gaonic period, we suddenly find other books called Megillat Tanit, which are Megillat Tanit Batra, the later Megillat Tanit, was the opposite. It's a list of days in which we're supposed to fast because of things that had happened, and we've studied about two of those fast days here, the 8th of Tevet and the 9th of Tevet, in previous years. And these days are, by the way, all listed in the Halachot Gedolot, and they're listed in several other early Rishonim, and the Shulchan Aruch has a whole siman where he lists all the days, and he says some of them are Rosh Chodesh, you should still fast. I don't know anybody who fasts on these days, maybe you do, but a whole long list of fasts. In Megillat Tanit Batra, and the one who's done really the yeoman's work on Megillat Tanit Batra is Shulamit Elitzur. In Megillat Tanit Batra, there are several versions, and by the way, most of the dates are yard sites. People died. So Rosh Chodesh Nisan in all of them is a fast day because of Nadav and Avihu. Whatever day Miriam died, and there's two different versions of that, is a fast day. Whatever day Yoshua died is a fast day. All right, so they're listed there. And Yoshua ben Nun, according to one, died on the 18th of Iyar. All right, so you take a look at it. The 18th of Iyar, this is in a version of a Gilat Tanit Batra that was found in the Geniza, in the Karu Geniza. The 18th of Iyar is a fast day for the death of Yoshua ben Nun and Harash. That's what it says. The earthquake. What earthquake? A four earthquake. Very strange. Right? No. What earthquake? All right. We got to figure out what this is about. So we have two large issues sitting in front of us. The first mention ever of Lag BaOmer is this. What's this earthquake? What happened? How did Lag BaOmer go from a fast day to a feast day? What's the story behind it? The second thing is, what's up with this Shem Bar Yochai's day of death, etc.? Okay. So we're gonna go in order. We're gonna start with the Pri Etz Chaim, and then we'll go to the fast day, to the earthquake. Reb Chaim Vital had the same legacy that many great Chachamim have. And that is that when they are either near or just after death, a battle ensues. I'm not talking about the battles that take place in certain communities over who gets to be the next rabbi, and then you have two communities, you know, fighting with each other. I'm talking about a different battle, which is usually a battle between the students and the family about the texts. The students usually are very zealous to try to publish their rebbe's material and get it out. And the family is often very guarded about it. Either they don't want it out at all, they want to be able to go over it. Uh-huh. And this is something that we've seen in our own generation with several people. And the same thing happened then. So Chaim Vital was sick. He was dying. His students were very interested in getting his material published. And so before the family could protest, they grabbed his manuscripts and they ran. And they went to the nearest printing press, the nearest one to Tzfat, which was in a city called Damascus. And there was a Jewish printer there. And they went to him. And remember, printing at the time was 200 years old. It was still very new. And they went to a typesetter, and they brought in the manuscript. And they said, quickly, you got to publish that. So he worked quickly, and he published it out. And that's the Pri Etz Chaim, the same Pri Etz Chaim we have today. You can go to the UCLA library and find it. I'm sure it's there. You can go to somebody with a very good personal library. You'll find it there. You could even buy it in a Sfarim store. Pri Etz Chaim, and you'll find exactly what you saw in source 1. But if you look at source 8, what do you have in front of you? What's source 8? Is the manuscript. That's the Ketav Yad. All right. Now this is a print of a copy of a, right? But this is the manuscript. Now take a look at it and you'll see something interesting. This is exactly the same paragraph that we had there. Bizman Hazeb, etc. About going out on Lag BaOmer. If you look at the arrow, you see the arrow on the third to last line. Okay, so go to the beginning of the line, and I'll read it. Shelamahu Omer Nachem biyom Simchati. Right, that was the line we saw. Why is this rabbi saying Nachem on my happy day? Vehatam Shin Mem Chub. See the line? Underneath the arrow, right after the arrow, there's a line. That's the formal name is Chupchik. Actually, no, it's called a Gerish. But it's, what it is, it's like an apostrophe. And we use it to show an abbreviation, right? You see it often when people write, like, the name Yehuda, they'll write Yod, Hey, Vav, Dalet, Chupchik, right? I don't want to write a Hey at the end. Or certain names that have Hashem's name at the end, they'll write just a Chupchik at the end. But chupchiks were used then more for saving space and for making sure the lines were even. And so what did he write? He wrote, V'lama shalama hu amer nachem biyom simchati v'hatam shin mem rashbi biyom lag ba'omer. Okay, so what did the printer do with shin mem? What did he do? Take a look. It's underlined in the print. Shemate. Right? He figured Shin Mem Chupchik is short for Shin Mem Tav. Which, by the way, is a little weird if you think about it, because a Tav and a Chupchik are about the same size. And therefore, what did he print?
So that died.
He died. But that's not what it means. What does it actually mean? Vahatam sim, Yom Simchat Rashbi Yom Lag Ba'omer. Because he just said it. Why is he saying Nachem on my happy day? It's the day of Simchat Rashbi. Didn't die that day. And then you understand what he meant. He was one of the Talmidim of Rabbi Akiva. So in other words, he was happy on this day because he wasn't part of that plague. Now, what is that? What is? Why was he happy on that day? We got to get back to the other piece and this earthquake.
So that's why he doesn't.
That's why he doesn't want this rabbi to say Nachem. Now, why is he so upset from the kever that this rabbi saying Nachem on my happy day? So let's say my birthday comes out on Tisha B'Av. So I don't want people to fast because my birthday was my happy day. What does that mean? It's got to be something more to it.
But does this still imply that the students died?
Not at all. Actually, it doesn't have anything to do with it.
So just, what does this have to do with them?
What?
Well, why is this day in particular a happy day?
Let's find out. Okay. Let's find out. Now, what happened in the year 311?
Constantine.
Mm-hmm. Constantine did what? He converted to Christianity, and the Roman Empire became the Holy Roman Empire. And this was not good news for the Jews. By the way, it hadn't been good news for the Jews before this either. But I'll ask you this question about Jewish-Christian relations. How do we interpret the Churban Beit HaMikdash? How do we interpret theologically the destruction?
We sinned.
It's our own moral failings. Sinat Chinam and a whole list of things, right? How do the Christians interpret the Churban Beit HaMikdash?
They didn't accept Jesus.
We didn't accept Jesus. We rejected him. And therefore, God rejects us. And the destroyed Beit HaMikdash is an eternal sign of damnation for those who rejected, right? God's great gift, supposedly. So you would think that the Roman Empire becoming the Holy Roman Empire, and by the way, the site of the Mikdash still being flat, the Harbite still being flattened, because they flattened it, that's what led to Bar Kokhba's rebellion, but they never did build that pagan temple there. So you would think that the Romans would have every interest in doing something else on there, or in certainly not allowing us to have any access. And indeed, from the time after Bar Kokhba's rebellion, for the next couple hundred years, Jews weren't allowed to go to Shalom. I think we were allowed to go once a year, on Tisha B'Av, to go and mourn. That was it. In the year 361, there was a new emperor who was elected, November of 361, by the name of Julian. And Julian is known throughout the history books as Julian the Apostate. Some people even call him Julian the Pagan. Because from the Christian perspective, that's who he was. Julian was in favor of re-establishing old Roman religion and old Roman practice. That's what he wanted to see happen. And he really wanted to stick it to the Christians. He really didn't like the Christians. By the way, he only lived a year and a half as emperor. He died in June of 363.
That's what happens when you don't like
it. Okay, so he... we have a letter that he wrote to the Jews, to the Jewish community, and he wanted to support the Jewish community. But it was really more, probably, me sinat haman than ahavat Mordechai. It was more that he really wanted to hurt the Christians. And so he sent a lot of Jewish community. He relieved them of certain taxes. He allowed them to go visit Jerusalem. And he said, I am going to allow you to rebuild the Beit HaMikdash. And I provided the materials. And the day was set. And as they were about to start building, with not only with Roman support, but Roman actual material support, suddenly a fire broke out, the materials were burned, then there was an earthquake, then there was a big devastation, and...
In Jerusalem.
And in Israel. And then, a month later, when the Jews were now ready to resubmit their request, Julian was killed on the battlefield. The next guy appointed was a Christian, and that was the end of that. Okay. Please take a look. By the way, the earthquake in 363 was the earthquake that was centered in the Galil, but had big impact in Yerushalayim also.
But we have documentation.
Please take a look. Please take a look. Yeah. Here is a letter that was recovered 20 years ago, 30 years ago, I think. Maybe longer, but certainly in the last 50, 100 years. A letter written by the Bishop of Jerusalem, Cyril, who was the bishop at the time of the Christian community. And of course, the Christian community was very interested in not seeing the Beit HaMikdash be rebuilt. And so he's telling it from his perspective. And he says at the outset, when they wanted to lay the foundations of the temple on the Sunday. So their Jews' plan was on a particular Sunday to lay the foundations. Makes sense. You want to start on Sunday. I have all week to work to the earthquake.
Was that the Christian Sabbath?
Yeah, but it probably wouldn't matter. There were strong winds and storms with the result that they were unable to lay the temple's foundations that day. It was on that very night that the great earthquake occurred, etc., etc. Now, take a look at paragraph 12. This event took place on Monday at the third hour, probably the ninth hour of the night. There was great loss of life here. It was on the 19th of Iyar of the year 674. The year 674 is 363 in the common era. All right? In other words, Monday was the 9th of Iyar, which means what was Sunday, the day they were going to build? The 18th of Iyar, otherwise known as Lag BaOmer. All right? So in other words, the Jews had planned to start their building on Lag BaOmer. That building was defeated. That building was never accomplished. And for the next umpteen years, certainly until the time of the Ari, everybody recognized that as a day where they had a chance to build the Beit HaMikdash, and then they weren't able to. So you now understand why they made a fast day. This is a day that they were this close to building the Beit HaMikdash. We had the Roman government behind us. We had materials with us. We're ready to build. And now, by the way, there are some historians who claim that it wasn't so much the earthquake that started the fire, that it was Christian arsonists who started the fire. We don't know. Either way, it doesn't matter. They were going to build the Beit HaMikdash. They were this close, and it didn't happen. So you understand why they made a fast day. You can even understand why some people said Nachem on that day. Because it's like a Tisha B'Av. We almost built the Beit HaMikdash, and then this fire broke out, and that was the end of it. You now understand Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai? Remember, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai is a student of Rabbi Akiva. What's the very famous story about Rabbi Akiva that everybody knows, mainly because people make Siyumim on Makot more often than anything else, because it's short? Rabbi Akiva, remember, it's a story that's in Source 6, right? That very famous story. Rabbi Akiva and his colleagues come to visit Yerushalayim. By the way, visit Yerushalayim, this is now in the year 90 or 100 or whatever it is, after the Churban. What's on the mountain?
Rubble.
There's not rubble, there's buildings. There's buildings there. You can't burn stone. There's just burned out buildings. Right? What do they see? They see a fox running out from Beit Kodesh HaKodeshim. What do the other Chachamim do? Everybody there, by the way, all tear their clothes, including Rabbi Akiva. What do the other Chachamim do? They weep. What does Rabbi Akiva do? He laughs. We all know the story. They say, why are you laughing? And of course he answers the question like he should, which is, why are you weeping? They say, weep? Are you kidding? The place where it says, Azara Krev Yumat, and the foxes are walking there, he says, that's why I'm laughing. Because if I see that the Nevuah about this is going to be fulfilled, I know that the Nevuah about Od Yeshu Zekeim Zekeinot, etc. is going to be fulfilled. And the famous last words are, Akiva Nechamtanu, Akiva Nechamtanu. What was Rabbi Akiva's big point? Is you can take a look at destruction and you see in the seeds of destruction rebuilding. You take a look at an event which is at the very nadir of our existence, and from it you can see the potential greatness. Rabbi Akiva's prize student was Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. And the element of Rabbi Akiva that was mystically oriented, that chiefly went to Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. So what's Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai's take on Lag BaOmer? Not this is a day when we almost built and it didn't happen. This is a day when we could build. This is a day when it will happen. Look at the potential. So he's saying, don't say Nachem. This is my happy day. Not my happy day, meaning my birthday, the day I won the lottery. Meaning it's the day that everybody should be happy based on my teachings. And that's why it's Yom Simchati. Don't say Nachem on this day. You don't understand the day correctly. And now you understand what the big celebration on Lag BaOmer is. Celebration on Lag BaOmer is a celebration of the Beit HaMikdash, because this is the day when potentially the Beit HaMikdash should be rebuilt. And it's an interesting and curious thing. If you look at the two sources at the bottom of page, back page, you'll see that both Shlomo and Zerubbabel, when they went to rebuild the Mikdash, began their building on the second month. As if they knew. The month of Iyar, the second month, is the month for building the Beit HaMikdash. Nisan is the month for the Mishkan. Iyar is the month for the Beit HaMikdash. That's when it's going to be rebuilt. One last point to this. And you know you don't hear me say this kind of stuff too often, but when it's right in front of you, it's kind of hard to avoid. As you know, when we count every evening, so many of us say the bracha, say the number, say the line, HaRachaman Yachzulanu. We talked about that last week. And then, you know, Aleinu. Some people say more, and they say Lam Natzeach, Psalm 67, they say the poem on the Bekoach, and they say Ribono Shel Olam. Ribono Shel Olam is a paragraph which has plugins, has variables, right? Which is that, which Al-Masha, L'takein, Al-Masha, Pagamti, Beh, and then you add in two Sfirot, and it's a matrix. And you've all seen it. And in many of the Sidurim, it's printed next to the day, it says, like, tonight, last night was Netzach Shebahod. All right, so the first night is Chesed Shebachesed, then Gvor Shebachesed, etc. After the first week, I don't know what it means. Anybody tells you they know what it means, run away because they don't know what I'm talking about. But it means something. All right, I mean, I have a vague idea, but better than vague I don't have. But always be wary of people who claim they know the answer to very mystical things. All right? But in any case, that entire system of Chesed Gvor Tiferet all emanates, sorry for the pun, from a drasha given by Rabbi Akiva. Go back to Rabbi Akiva. It's in Source 9. You all know the pasuk, L'cha Adonai Gdula V'Gvura V'Tiferet V'Netzach V'Hod, L'cha Adonai Mamlacha V'Nesed L'Chol Rosh. Right? Rabbi Akiva gave a drasha on this, in which he said, the pasuk, of course, is in from Divrei Yamim Aleph Chavtet, Vayvarach David. He says, L'cha Adonai Gdula Zu Kriyat Yam Suf, V'Gvura Zu Makat Bechorot, Tiferet Zu Matan Torah, Netzach Zu Yerushalayim. And by the way, the Maharal named much of his prodigious output after this midrash, because he wrote a book about Yitzhak Mitzrayim and he called it Gvurot Hashem. He wrote a book about Matan Torah and he called it Tiferet Yisrael. He wrote a book about Tisha B'Av and he called it Netzach Yisrael, all based on this pasuk, on this drasha. The Sfirot all kind of emanate from here. Gdula is, how do you call it, Chesed, Gvura is Gvura, Tiferet, right? Netzach, Hod, and then Mamachavi Nasei is Yisrael Malchut. Notice what he says about Hahod. Hahod zeh Beit HaMikdash. So, curiously or otherwise, Rabbi Kirshenbaum, what are you going to say tonight? What's the sphere tonight? Hod Shebahod. In other words, it's the whole Beit HaMikdash. Hod Shebahod, it's the essence of the Beit HaMikdash. His Lag Ma'omer. And now you can see the background to it. And you can see this is the day which is deliberately mysterious because it's not a day of celebrating the past. It's a day in which you're celebrating a potential future. The future of the rebuilding of the Beit HaMikdash. B'mehirah v'yameinu.